The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show, brought to you by Absa CIB, powering Africa's renewable energy transformation, the bravery to imagine. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Grace Harding will chat to us in a moment. Grace is the CEO of Ocean Basket. She also is the CEO of the Restaurant Collective. And I saw a really impassioned appeal over the weekend from her to property owners, to commercial property owners, to asset managers, about the hardships that the industry is going through. And it's a long time since we've caught up on the general health of the sector, which you would imagine is doing a lot better today than it was during the dark days of the hard lockdowns. And so as a result of that, you would think, well, they're out of the woods. It would appear not. We'll pick up on that in a bit. SAA isn't quite the beast it once was, and therefore has lots of spare capacity in things like business class lounges. And so a little bit of smart thinking is taking over, and we are seeing a partnership with Discovery Bank. Discovery Bank looking at ways of incentivizing its top-end card holders to be loyal, and so finding an opportunity there. We'll pick up on that with Hilton Kalner, Chief Executive at Discovery Bank, in just a little bit. A new venture fund to invest in early-stage tech startups across the continent. That's at 20 to 7. Our Tech with Toby feature, Toby Shepard, the chief at Stuff Studios, joins us. We'll also catch up with the author of Mindfulness. Mindfulness is not a brand new concept, but it is a particularly well-timed book by Helen Nicholson, who is at the networking company, and she has written a book on how to stay sane in an insane world. Insane world. And then Kaiser Hanyaho from the SIU, the Special Investigating Unit, on his money. I think this is going to be an interesting one, because Kaiser has been working in the public sector for decades at the SABC before the SIU, and in the Department of Justice before that. So I think he's got a career in the public service, which guarantees him a pension one day. But I wonder how worried he is about the health of that pension, the potential of that pension to deliver on his expectations, and whether or not he is putting money away in his own capacity for a rainy day, and what the rules and regulations around that might be one of these days. But anyway, that's what is on your agenda this evening here on The Money Show.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
As I said, SAA, a shadow of what it once was, and as a result, there's lots of spare capacity there. In particular, if you go through the airports, it feels like a bit of a ghost town at some times of the day, in particular when you look across at the SAA business class lounges. They have been significantly underutilized for the last 2 years. Well, Discovery Bank, which has now signed up 1 million customers since its launch in 2020, is looking at ways of incentivizing its customers to be loyal. And in the tradition of airports, this is where the bank's elite customers tend to hang out. We have seen various banks try to add some value, provide some lounge access, provide a place where you can kick back your heels. Of course, famously, we have seen FNB's system, its scheme, tie people into the slow lounge. Well, today, Discovery Bank announcing a deal with SAA's business class lounges. Hilton Kalner is the Discovery Bank chief executive. And this is, I suppose, underutilized real estate within airports, Hilton, and an opportunity for a collaboration. Are you taking it over, or is it really a collaboration?
Bruce, the lounge initiative is actually part of a broader strategic partnership with SIA that we announced today. We brought SIA onto our network of flight partners. So our Vitality and Discovery Bank customers will now get discounts when they fly on SIA, as they do with all of our other airlines. So that's a positive development. And then our Discovery Bank clients get access to the lounges. We are going to be investing significantly. The lounges, I think, as you said, are large. They're in fantastic positions across all of the airports. Airport lounges, while as you say, you know, I think that they're popular, they actually are quite difficult to establish, just given the limited real estate. And so we'll be investing significantly to upgrade the lounges and really sort of, I suppose, take advantage of the space that's there, and it'll be great for our customers and hopefully very good for SAA customers as well.
So it's a deal with SAA or is it a deal with the airports company in South Africa, which is the property owner in these cases? Just how secure is your contract based on the fluidity of SAA's finances? I'm going to put it nicely like that.
So it's a contract with SAA, but we've obviously secured rights within that give us comfort around longevity. And obviously they've got a long established relationship with AXA as well.
Okay, and then the extent of this arrangement, how long does it last for? Because also with these sorts of deals, they're not on a never-ending basis. Is it a 1, 2, 3, 5-year contract?
Yeah, I mean, this is a long-term contract, so we can't obviously disclose the details, but we envisage this to be a long-term partnership, and hence the sort of the capital investment that we'll be making in the lounges, and hopefully it'll be great for both partners.
It's a nice opportunity for you because I know you've been intending to do this right from the very start when you joined Discovery Bank as chief executive. You wanted to create the lounge because it was a nice counter to some of your rivals who already have that sort of access within the airport. This does actually save you, I think, quite a lot of time and effort and possibly money in terms of getting in on the prime spots that SAA has occupied for decades.
Yeah, I think the entire airport experience was important to us. So we've rolled out fast-track priority lanes that allow our customers to bypass or sort of go through on an accelerated basis. The security in domestic departures, we're now rolling that out in international arrivals as well. The lounge then gives our customers a place to sort of, as you say, sit back and relax. Once they through that process and they enjoy the services of the lounge.
Is this for
great economic activity? Sorry, Bruce.
No, absolutely. There's a huge amount of interaction, and deals are done, and people see each other in the spots, and you see all sorts of interesting people in the lounges. In terms of the class of sort of customer you need to be of Discovery Bank. This can't be for everybody. You've got a million customers. You can't have everybody turning up at the airport on the same day. So I'm guessing this is also an incentive for people to buy up in terms of the offerings that you have. And I suppose with the Vitality tie-in, there'll be certain behavioural aspects which will be required for access to these lounges.
So we've actually made the access very broad. It's available to all of the Discovery Bank customers with a platinum, black or purple card. So it really is a very broad offering. For the rest of the calendar year of 2022, there's unlimited use. And you can also take in up to 4 guests with you as a Discovery Bank client at any point in time. So you can bring your family, you could bring friends that you're traveling with. We really want to encourage our customers to enjoy the lounge. From next year, there will be limits to the complimentary access, depending on the account type, but essentially from 4 to 40 visits per annum, plus international visits. So we've been quite liberal with the sort of the limits that our customers will have access to, and as I say, completely unlimited for the rest of this calendar year.
What is the attraction of airports as a mechanism for incentives? It's not, I mean, for people who travel regularly, it's never a pleasant experience. I mean, it's very glamorous from the outside, I suppose. Oh, we go to the business class lounge. Oh, you're flying here. Oh, you're flying there. You know, generally, travel is a bit of a schlep and more of a schlep in a COVID world and in a world that is security conscious as well. I suppose it's a way of buying goodwill from people who generally can afford absolutely anything except through the rigmarole of the airport.
So I think busy airports are a sign of economic activity. So they really are. They're a great thing. But they, as you say, they can be a hassle. And there's a lot of queuing, and that's important. That's necessary in the context of an airport. But it's also an opportunity for organisations like ourselves to streamline the process for our clients to really make it a pleasant experience and a unique experience. And having first-hand experience of our priority fast track lane at international arrivals after a long overnight flight, you feel like a celebrity. When you sort of just bypass the entire queue. And that's what we aim to make our clients feel like. And that's what's really driving the growth of the bank.
Hilton Calder, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive at Discovery Bank. Want to feel like a celebrity? There's your insight. That's the way it feels. For kicks. But you could get hissed at by people standing in the normal queues. Let's talk to Grace Harding now. I mean, where airports are beginning to fill up and we're beginning to see queues at airports, there are fewer queues and fewer economic opportunities happening in the country's malls. More and more vacancies are prevalent. And I saw an appeal over the weekend on LinkedIn from Grace Harding, the Chief Executive at Ocean Basket, appealing to landlords for reason when it comes to negotiating leases for restaurant space. She entitled the piece 2,000 plus malls in South Africa, an open letter to landlords, and she writes, "Dear asset managers and property owners, COVID was horrible for us, for you. Now the economy is under further pressure and neither of us on easy street. How do we shift our relationship from you being a lord and me being a servant? The restaurant industry, and I'm sure many other businesses who need to recover and thrive, are bruised and battered. Let's swap the bat with a chat." Let's catch up with Grace Harding this evening. Just tell me in practical terms about these relationships, Grace, which have been really, really quite fraught for an awfully long time. Not just restaurants, but mom and pop operators, smaller businesses, long have complained about the relationship with landlords, particularly in the big centres, the glory centres, the centres that are very attractive to many tenants. How tough is that relationship right now?
The relationship is very tough, and I always feel bad. I don't want to feel like I'm landlord bashing, but I think sort of coming out of COVID, if that's what we're doing, entering like from the frying pan into the fire, we are seeing landlords really in the main being quite inflexible, and it is the bigger ones. So people really do want to pay back their loans. They cannot pay it all back at once. And they're starting to say, okay, well, we'll just get you out then. We'll send you a letter, release you of your lease. So it's interesting to see where all of this will go, because as we know, everything in the world is shifting. And the key tenants that are considered key at the moment are the ones with the most opportunity to become bigger and bigger online. If you look at the big retailers, whereas a restaurant is never going to be something where people can go out to eat in their own house. So we mustn't confuse delivery with eating out. So it's not working, and we're not getting around the table yet. And there's just all these costs upon costs upon costs. And we've got to do something different.
So what are you hoping you can achieve by making this public appeal? We've approached a whole bunch of landlords today saying, please would you come on with Grace and chat about it, and let's see if we can get some sort of toenadering, for want of a better word. And, oh, terribly sorry, closed period. Oh, terribly busy. Sorry about that. No, can't do that. No. Has anybody approached you directly and said, Grace, yes, let's have a chat? Or are they avoiding you like they seem to be avoiding us?
Wow, I'm so glad you did that. No, they haven't spoken to me yet. And yes, Ocean Basket's important, and so is the whole of the restaurant industry, because the restaurant collective is a huge responsibility too. So I'm not going to give up. We have to have a conversation, because there is no longevity. At the end of the day, restaurants will make another plan. They will move out of the big centres because they have to. They have no choice. I mean, there's base rental, there's operations costs, there's taxes, there's utility costs. You know, I have to pay towards the bill, the whole center's rubbish, and then I have to pay for my own rubbish, and then I have to pay for the government to fetch my rubbish, and then I have to pay a turnover clause. And we certainly don't begrudge anyone to make a profit, but there's got to be another way of remolding this tenant agreement and this financial model.
And what power do you have? I mean, you've got 200 restaurants, mostly located in big malls inside South Africa. You have more power than most, but if they're not prepared to engage with you, what do you do?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I hope that the other restaurant chains join me. I know definitely the exec in charge of the sit-down restaurants at Famous Brands works very, very closely with me. And I'm sure the other groups, Spur, and any other groups who've got restaurants. I don't know. It does feel fairly powerless, but nothing should ever be given up on, should it? So we're just going to continue. And as we face these challenges, we have no choice but to remove our restaurants from these malls, and we'll make another plan.
And that's the thing. I mean, especially when you look at, you know, communities and lots of these little regional and little community malls, there's lots of space available. It's not like the landlords are sitting in the pound seats with the power on their side. But they must be looking at you, Grace, and saying, hold on, Grace. But yes, in the hard lockdown, we cut you some slack. We gave some rental holidays. We did all sorts of things to ensure that you survived. You've survived. Your customers are coming back to the restaurants. If anything, you know, we're seeing fairly decent volumes coming through our doors. We're doing our bit to give you the security you need, to give you the generators and the backup that you need within our malls. You know, you're in recovery mode. We need to recover too. Are you playing fair in this particular space at the moment, Grace?
Absolutely. I mean, we all need to recover. So there's two things that are hugely concerning. The one is coming to fetch the money that was lost. And that's why I ended the article by saying nobody lost anything because we never made it. So I don't know how my restaurants are going to pay back stuff that they didn't even make in the first place. So now we're trying to recuperate. As we're trying to recover, oil goes up 46%. We all know what's happening with electricity. Some malls definitely offer generators, not all. So it's not about saying, well, no, tough luck, we want to be fine. But it's about saying, won't we understand each other better if we just drink tea together? Because all that's happening now is that I bat the ball to them and they bat the ball to me. But somewhere, somehow, we've got to get on the same side of the course, don't we?
Thank you very much to Grace Harding. Grace is the chief executive at Ocean Basket. My producers say they bashed the phones extensively today looking for landlords. If you are a landlord who's willing to open the batting with Grace Harding, chief executive at Ocean Basket, you'd like to do it through us this evening. We'd love to have you. But yeah, looking at the turnover clauses, of course, very, very big issue, and it's been a big issue for a long time. The utility costs linked to restaurants are high, the rates and taxes that they're supposed to pay, the operations costs. Tenants pay a percentage of the cost to run the centre itself. And I suppose, you know, and the landlords, of course, have to absorb some costs, which they then recuperate through, I suppose, things like parking and others, the other issues. There's the base rental. Those are the big costs when it comes to renting space in a mall. And if you've ever run a small business in a mall, and if you've got a franchise, it is essentially a small business. You know just how tough it is. Your calls this evening, your thoughts on what Grace Harding has shared with us this evening, the hardship of the restaurant trade, particularly in this case, in the franchises.
The Money Show.
The Market.
On to Arthur Karas at Old Mutual Investment Group. He's our market commentator this evening. And Arthur Karas, welcome to The Money Show tonight. US markets are closed for a public holiday, and that seems to have caused things to calm down quite a lot globally, where European markets have been positive and the JSE today certainly had a much calmer day.
Yes, we've had a very difficult period, really on the back of that that huge U.S. inflation number, which has led to everyone being quite convinced that we're going to see some very sharp interest rate hikes. And that's led to concerns about those ultimately leading to recession and hence a very rough couple of days during a rough month.
Yeah, but it has been rough, and I'm hoping you can hear me, Arthur. The line doesn't sound great this evening. What were the standout features of today's JSE trading for you?
I think what we could see is some of the differences in some of the underlying stocks coming through. So our mining stocks did quite well, being Glencore and Anglo American, partly on the back of a very good trading update from Glencore last week. But then on the other hand, BHP Billiton, the world's biggest mining company, which earns the majority of its money from iron ore these days, had a rough day on the back of that. Our banks, looking very good, again last week came out with about a 7% increase, that being for May, in their lending. So that seems to show that South Africans are coming back and lending, both corporates and individuals. So that seems to suggest that the SA banks are still in quite a good space. Then amongst those, we also had the more defensive stocks like a ShopRite, the kind of company that you think will be able to deliver profits even while inflation is going up and consumers are being squeezed. Those companies doing well. The bottom of the table, the platinum miners, I think they need people to be buying cars, and that's becoming a bit of a concern, even as the car companies still struggle to produce cars these days. So that's the kind of picture that we had this today.
Yeah, and it's quite encouraging. I was looking at Business Times yesterday and just looking at the list of potential listings over the next year for the JSE. And we're seeing a few delays in terms of listings. People are waiting for markets to settle down a little bit, and goodness knows if and when that happens. But Coca-Cola Africa has already told us, due to macroeconomic conditions, they're postponing their listing. But there's Sedibelo Resources, there's Fidelity Security, African Bank wants to come back to the market, Premier Foods, and then, of course, Altsurance. I don't know if it's a new listing because it's essentially RMI, Rand Merchant Insurance, but it is, there is some activity and there is some interest in listing, which I think has come, will come as a bit of a relief to the JSE, which has taken quite a lot of strain.
Absolutely. We've had a shrink in the listings. We've had a couple of tough years on the JSE in general, and I think the state of the market, so the enthusiasm of the market for new listings, I think, is the key determinant in when you want to list. Because, after all, if you're the owner of a company bringing it to market, you only really have one opportunity to cash in. So you need a stronger stock market. We've had a fairly good stock market. I mean, this year is now slipping into negative territory. But we've had a better stock market, and that, I think, has sparked people saying, right, this is a good time. Let's try and get those listings away.
Yeah, look, it can't come a moment too soon based on how many delistings we have seen from the JSE. And I suppose if there was one little silver lining on the day, that silver lining came in the form of an oil price, which has come off quite sharply. Oil price down to $112, $113 a barrel, still high by historical standards, but it's the sort of movement we need to see sustained in order to take a little bit of pressure off of the inflationary picture, because probably by the end of this week, we're going to be outside of the Reserve Bank's target range of 3 to 6% on the wrong side. Higher than 6% inflation this week is what I'm expecting. I don't know about you.
Definitely. I think we're going to continue to see strong inflation prints, and we're going to continue to see rates edging up. The one interesting thing out of this is that the gap in our inflation rates and our interest rates between ourselves and that of our major trading partners, if you just look at the difference between home loans in the US and home loans in South Africa, that used to be enormous, and that gap has closed substantially. And it's something that we're quite used to in our economy. It's not something that they're used to on the other side. So while interest rates go up, it's actually hurting, in many respects, the developed markets more than it's hurting us. We're not even back to where we were pre-COVID yet. So, but definitely lower oil price is a good thing for markets, good thing for economies, and it'll give the Federal Reserve a little bit of pause as to how fast they raise interest rates.
Thank you very much to Arthur Karras. Arthur is with the Old Mutual Investment Group. He is a portfolio manager on the line to us this evening from Cape Town. I also see today that Warren Buffett's announced that he has donated about $4 billion worth of Berkshire Hathaway stock to his charitable foundations for what is they call the annual summer gift. And this is the 17th year in a row in which he has made a huge donation of this kind. $14 billion? Was that 60 billion rand? So far, over the last 17 years, Warren Buffett has donated $48 billion. $48 billion. That's enough to run South Africa for 6 months. 5 months if you let the crooks take their share. But yeah, 6 months. And that's the vast amount of money that one of the world's most ardent capitalists, who has made his money through financial markets, has given away over the last 17 years. $48 billion.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB, powering Africa's renewable energy transformation. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. It's interesting to see that Colombia, has elected a socialist economist and senator by the name of Gustavo Petro as its president. And it's a big change for that particular country. It's the first round of presidential elections in May saw the traditional conservative and liberal parties lose. And there were two candidates in the runoff. And it's opposite extremes. And it shows just how polarized the world has become, because you've got a leftist economist in Gustavo Petro and a right-wing businessman called Rodolfo Hernandez, called the Trump of Colombia, going up against each other. Both have developed populist campaigns, one populist right-wing, one populist left-wing, and the populist left-wing won. And the new president, Gustavo Petro, the left winger, he heads a party called the Historic Pact Party. It's a coalition of 20 socialist, indigenous and ecological parties in Colombia. And yeah, he's the new president there. And it's interesting to see how the shifts that we're seeing in the world, the center, the liberal center, certainly is crumbling to pressure from both left and right. On the Next Money Show, we've got our investment school headmaster this week will be Rand Swiss portfolio manager Gary Boyson, helping you navigate the pitfalls of investing and growing your portfolio in deeply chaotic and uncertain times. Andy Rice with these heroes and zeros from the world of advertising, plus, of course, the Africa Business Report and all the other big money stories of the day next time here on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
If you're in it, you'll know that you're in it. Stage 2 load shedding from 5 until 10 tonight. So 5 this afternoon until 10 this evening. Eskom saying that load shedding is due to, oh, look at that, continued shortage of generation capacity. The same thing as the last 15 years. It currently has got 5,232 megawatts on planned maintenance and another 14,200 megawatts of broken capacity due to breakdowns that were not foreseen. So, yeah, three times as much almost capacity out because of breakdowns. And then, of course, the planned maintenance of 5,232. A chunk of that will be, of course, the Coburg Power Station, which is being refueled and refurbished and redone this year in two phases. Eskom says, yeah, please be careful. Electricity is rare and scarce and short. There are big shortages and, yeah, load shedding schedules, of course, in place. And that's going to happen at least from today, at least all the way until Thursday.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Catch up this evening with Junaid Duplessis. Junaid is the co-founder and managing director of Launch Africa Ventures. And Launch Africa Ventures started out in the height of COVID-19, not only has persisted, but appears to have thrived in the face of some of the most challenging investment environments for the continent in recent decades. Co-founder of Launch Africa Ventures, Junaid Duplessis, on the line to us this evening from Amsterdam. The idea to at Launch, I think, Junaid, has been to invest in early stage tech startups across the continent. Have you discovered some gems as you have gone through the process of investigating what is and is not available?
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. Yeah, indeed. We're a Pan-Africa seed stage company, fund at investing tech startups. And there are certainly gems in our portfolio. Obviously, I'm biased, but we've invested in 116 companies in the past 22 months across 20 different African countries. And of the 116 companies, already 44 of those companies are raising their next rounds. And some have already closed those rounds. And overall, our portfolio is up an IRR of 50% since we started.
That's not bad going through it. That's not bad going through a pandemic, Junaid. I mean, that's, you know, clearly canny choices and making investment decisions and sticking with those investment decisions is powerful. We're often told that there are not that many investment opportunities across the African continent. I suppose it does depend on your risk appetite as to what you deem to be investable. If you're in a pension fund, a lot of what you might invest in might not be appropriate for more conservative investors. Just how much risk are you sort of being obliged to take in order to get these investments over the line?
Yeah, we do take a lot of risk because we invest in early stage companies. And those, our goal is to get them through what we traditionally call the valley of death. So our companies typically have only 20,000 monthly recurring revenue, and we try to get them to 100,000, and that's what we provide, not only financial support, but also non-financial support, getting the team in place, making sure that they have enough corporate contracts, and ensuring that the right governance structures are in place. High risk, high return. And so for us to come in at that stage means that we have to add a lot more value to our portfolio companies.
I think you said you've done 112 investments so far. How many of those have fallen over in this time?
Well, we're still 22 months old. I keep us to remind our team. Of the 116, actually, Bruce, we don't have any failures. There are about two that that we work very actively with in the portfolio companies. And in both, we have put a turnaround specialist to help with the founding teams to enable to get them on the right path again. And again, it's we're a B2B fund. So a lot of the failures or the companies that struggle is probably the ones that are not getting corporate contracts or being able to work with corporates as efficiently as we had hoped to when we did the initial investment.
Where's the biggest concentration of investments out of the 116 across the continent?
Yeah, so we have about 44% of our portfolio is fintech, but fintech is a very broad term. So fintech is remittances, payments, credit, asset management, banking, financial infrastructure. So we are very positive on fintech, and we do think that there's a consolidation play that will come in the next 2 to 3 years. The majority of our portfolio, around 33%, is in Nigeria, followed by South Africa, where we've done 24 investments across multiple sectors. But we've invested in 20 other countries. I think the next fund is only invested in 9 countries. So we see ourselves as a frontier fund in that in our industry, there's a lot of FOMO. We're the first investor in the DRC, for example, through a company called MaxiCash, the first fintech in Kinshasa, and now we've seen a lot more investments happening in the DRC. So we've invested in all regions, 20 countries and all regions across Africa.
And where does the funding come from? I mean, you've got, I think you raised $36 million, which is no small amount of money. Where does it come from? Who are your investors on whose behalf you invest?
So our investor strategy was quite unique. So we specifically targeted executives at large corporates, global corporates. And in the past 22 months that we've raised a capital, we've actually have 238 high net worth individuals in our business and family offices. Our biggest corporate investor is the second largest bank in Germany called Commerzbank, and they've invested through their venture capital arm. To date, we've actually deployed $26 million, and what's unique about our fund is we allow our investors to co-invest alongside our fund as well. So our co-investors has invested an additional $20 million on top of our $24 million. So across the continent, in Rand terms, that would have been around 730 million Rand that have deployed. And we're in the process at the moment of raising our next fund.
And I mean, we need to, unfortunately, 10, 20, 30, 50 times more than that to really shift, and I hate the term, shift the needle across this continent. How many competitors do you have? How ferocious is the battle looking for assets across the African continent? Or is it a bit like Clem Santos said to me 15 years ago? He was talking to members of the Chinese Politburo, and they said they loved Africa because there were no Americans there competing with them. Are you finding lots of competition, or is there sort of virgin territory for you to exploit?
No, I think in our sector, it's slightly unique. So if you look just at the numbers of last year, $5 billion was invested in 860 startups in Africa. Just to contextualize it, there's about 6,500 startups across the continent. Only 860 got investment. So $5 billion. If you break that $5 billion down, actually 55 were foreign capital. So we're really encouraging more capital to fill the gap of the other startups that are raising. And we welcome foreign investments. And that's why we have positioned ourselves as the trusted partner on the ground. We provide co-investment opportunities with no fees and carry to all investors that come alongside us. We do all the work for them. And so we need more capital on the African continent. I think what makes VC in Africa quite unique is that there isn't a sense of competition. It's really around collaboration. So we work with Kelon Ventures in South Africa on a number of deals, sharing terms and as well as pipelines.
Thank you very much, Janaid Duplessis, the partner of Launch Africa Ventures, on the line to us this evening from Amsterdam. That is who the guest is this evening here on The Money Show. In a moment, Toby Shapshak, the chief at Stuff Studios, we're going to talk about Huawei with Google and the difference that that makes in a moment.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
I was chatting about this with someone the other day, having flown from Dubai to the World Economic Forum in one of those massive double-decker Airbus A380s. And they're just enormous. And at the beginning of the lockdowns, they were written off as this oversized, what's the word you're looking for? Anachronism, I suppose. And COVID-19 really tried its very best to break the global airline industry. And we saw this plane, the world's biggest passenger plane, fall by the wayside, and airlines were parking the things in the desert. I think Qantas put 12 of these in the California desert, saying, well, they won't need them for at least 3 years. Etihad said that it's 10. These sort of super aircraft, these Airbus A380s, would never fly again. But it's quite interesting that with the resurgence in air travel that we're seeing in many parts of the world, we are beginning to see demand once again for the double-decker aircraft. Now, that's a bit of a bummer because, as far as I can recall, Airbus said that they were going to stop manufacturing them. Maybe there are enough in the world. I don't know. But there's been this big recovery, and these massive jets, which can take about 500 people each, are suddenly becoming the aircraft of choice, particularly with oil prices the way they are. I think they're fairly fuel efficient per passenger. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see how this one plays out in terms of the desire of passengers, the willingness of passengers to fly on these enormous aircraft to get to their destinations. I think BA says it's going to operate more A380 flights by the end of this year than it did before COVID. So that's pretty interesting. The aircraft to and from South Africa remain small and the frequencies are low and the prices are stratospheric. But it's interesting to see that the A380 isn't completely dead in the water.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Chief of Stuff Studios, Toby Shapshak with us this evening. The Honor Magic 4 Pro smartphone. I've never heard of the Honor Magic 4 Pro smartphone. Why would I care about this one, Toby Shapshak?
Well, that's a very good question, Bruce Whitfield. You haven't asked me my impression of double-decker airlines, but nonetheless, double-decker planes, very lovely, especially if you're on the double deck of the double-decker. But nonetheless, Huawei has been the victim of, I don't know how to phrase it. They were kind of something that former President Donald Trump took a shot at, and
well, the whole paranoia around Chinese spyware and Huawei, that sort of thing. But the smartphones are separate from this.
Weird. So Huawei, as we know, the largest manufacturer of telecoms equipment, was suddenly put on this blacklist by America. It's hard not to look at it as economic sabotage. There was never ever any evidence produced. Some securocrats in the industrial military complex trying to convince a clearly gullible president there was an issue, presidents. And nonetheless, Honor is a sub-brand of Huawei, and they're a very good brand, I have to say. So it's really interesting how they have managed to kind of continue to be a really brilliant brand of devices. Now, remember that they're kind of considered a kind of cheaper version of Huawei, but they are anything but, I must say. And what differentiates them, and a lot of people in the market, as you alluded to, Bruce, say it's like using Huawei with Google, because Huawei's hardware is fantastic. Their cameras are amazing. Their screens are amazing. They make their own processors. Everything about a Huawei device is fantastic. And of course, a lot of this goes into Honor. And the Honor top-end smartphone that we've just been playing with there at Stuff Studios is the Honor Magic 4 Pro smartphone. And it's a very, very, very good device. It's got three cameras on the back, Bruce. Two 50 megapixels, one wide, one ultra wide, and a 64 megapixel periscope telephoto camera. Incredibly good quality pictures. But of course, one of the things Huawei's also done very well, apart from screen technology, and this is a very good screen, is they have very good battery life. So this is a 4,600 milliamp battery. 5,000 is the kind of regular average. But what's significant about this battery is how fast you can charge it. And Bruce, I got to tell you, that's one of the things I'm now very interested in. USB-C, this new charging cable that is now, the EU wants to be the standard in Europe, so Apple's going to have to move away from their Lightning to sell it in Europe, and hopefully that'll impact us in South Africa as well. But USB-C allows incredibly fast charging, and what you can do with the big charger, in this instance with the Honor Magic 4 Pro, is you can charge your phone 4,600 milliamp battery in 100% in just, brace yourself, Bruce, 30 minutes. My, I mean, that's really something quite significantly. They say they can do 100 watts wireless charging. They can do 60% of this battery in 15 minutes. Now, that's just fantastic. I don't know about you, Bruce, but I long since gave up the idea that your phone will last, your phone's battery will last you the whole day. It never does. We just use our phones too much. We turn the screen, the brightness of the screen up really high. You want to save battery life, turn your screen down, watch how bad the experience is as soon as you do that. So I know that I'm never going to get through the day. I have a charger next to my desk at home, at the office, one in my car. You know, I even have a battery booster in my cubbyhole in case I go somewhere and I need to charge my phone. It's just life, right? But to charge your phone, fully charge your phone in 30 minutes, Bruce, I dare you to find a statistic better than that anywhere on the internet tonight.
So the Honor Magic 4 Pro smartphone, swift charging, it's Huawei with Google. It's about 23 grand for a decent model, and it's
8 gigabytes with 250 highly competitive storage. Yeah, indeed. And what's really great is that Mr. Zhao, who used to be the country manager for Huawei South Africa, is now the regional director for Honor EMEA. And I bumped into him last week at the launch. Really great guy. Really cares about South Africa and the South African marketplace. So, like, really great to see him moving on up the food chain, but still having a nice impact in South Africa.
Awesome. Thank you, Toby Shapshak, the chief at Stuff Studios.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
The difference between the public sector and private sector in terms of internships, I find so interesting and so different to my own experience of having interned and having been in offices where people have been interns, is that you have hungry, capable young people with absolutely no work experience, with absolutely zero clue what the job requires, what the business requires, and they arrive and they do the menial work. They do make the tea. They go and make the photocopies. They go and carry the packages from floor to floor. They find out how the place works. And the very best find a gap and find an opportunity, and they become very successful within organizations. 99% of interns probably come in, spend a week or two feeling bewildered, and disappear out the back door. But it's those that, perform that then get into the jobs. And I don't know what sort of hit rate government was hoping for with its internship programs, but clearly they're not being run very well if the people who are welcoming the interns into the organizations aren't properly challenging them, aren't looking for the potential, and the young people they are bringing in are not seizing the opportunities that are there. Because I promise you, there are gaps in every single government department that could be filled by feisty young individuals who are saying, hold on a second, this is my opportunity to shine, and looking for opportunities within organizations. It's a weird, I think, dichotomy between public and private sectors. The Money Show is brought to you by Absa CIB, powering Africa's renewable energy transformation. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
And let's look at what is happening in the world of manufacturing. And certainly South Africa does not have a great track record of manufacturing. We've got some very vibrant industries and we've got some very capable industries, but it's not second nature necessarily to many South Africans to be in manufacturing. It's just been too tough to do it in South Africa for too long. Well, the latest research, Economic Research Quarterly Manufacturing Survey, shows that confidence in the sector plunged to a level of 29 in the second quarter of 2022 from a level of 43, already quite muted in the first quarter, but nearly halved in the second quarter. And broad-based, a loss of confidence. Let's talk to Justin Schmidt, the head of manufacturing sector at Absa Retail and Business Bank this evening. Justin, talk to me about confidence in the manufacturing sector. I can't say that I'm too shocked and surprised, but what does the data tell us in terms of what is and is not working?
Hi, Bruce. Yes, I think you said it was muted in quarter one. I'm surprised that it was holding up as much as it did, and it did tick up. In quarter two, though, all these supply chain or these supply shocks are really showing in all the sectors. So like you say, everyone printed below 50, even someone like the textiles industry, which has surprisingly been very confident in recent quarters and the whole of last year. Really, everyone broad-based is feeling those shocks, whether it's the Ukraine and Russia invasion, the energy issue we have here, passing as well as forward-looking demand. So I do think it's just the perfect storm for manufacturers at the moment.
How much of it is domestic confidence and how much of it is a global perspective in terms of confidence? Because there are just so many different brickbats with which manufacturers are being beaten right now.
Yeah, so last quarter was interesting. It was the invasion, and there was a bit of positivity. I think now with that coming through the oil prices, there has been a global kind of concern. So where we are seeing that is exports. So a lot of manufacturers are saying, well, the export expectations as well as currently are a bit suppressed versus previously they had high hopes for the remainder of the year to say, well, we think demand's going to be there. Similarly, locally, manufacturers are also saying, well, local demand is showing up. So we do think that it's, you know, it's the inflation globally. A lot of manufacturers were saying that they are concerned about interest rate hikes and also the cost of oil and things like that. Load shedding also popped up a lot. So a lot of concern globally, but I think these local factors are really weighing on manufacturers.
And then there's, I mean, we've also got the issues for manufacturers, and we've seen certainly the miners report on this, the citrus farmers have reported on this, and this is the crumbling nature of rail infrastructure and port infrastructure. It's all well and good. You can make as many widgets as you like, but if you can't get them from your factory gate to the port and get them onto a boat and to your market, well, then of course you're going to lose confidence. And I think that infrastructure failing has also been quite substantial in our attitude to and our outlook.
Yes, so there's also some positives around there. With the struggling.
Oh, Justin, we're struggling with, and my confidence in your cell phone is beginning to drop. It started at 75, it dropped to 50, and is now sitting at about 3. Let's try that again. Sorry, you say there is some upside in terms of the outlook in terms of infrastructure?
Yes, so a lot of manufacturers are actually finding opportunities where it's more costly to...
And we're never going to know, Justin. I tell you what, Justin, why don't you go and stand on your chair or something? I've put you on hold for a moment so you can make any embarrassing noises you need to. Maybe swear a little at your phone. Maybe stand on your chair. My producers will give instructions on how to do that without breaking your neck. We don't need the drama, by the way, of you falling off your chair during the Money Show. I'm looking for the silver lining. I'm looking for the opportunity that Justin has found. But we've been cursed. Oh, and then he's gone. We've been cursed by the gods. Get him back, please. We need to know what the opportunity is. honestly. We saw City Lodge with a trading update today, and City Lodge says all of their South African hotels have been open since February, which is really, really good. 47% occupancy for the month in South African operations, more corporates and government departments resuming travel. 47% is low by historical standards, but what a relief. May 22 achieved occupancies of 52%, which is pleasing. So there's definitely a recovery happening in the hotel sector, according to City Lodge. Sorry, Justin Schmidt, in terms of manufacturing, where do you see the hope?
Sorry, I've jumped onto that chair, Bruce. So we are seeing manufacturers see opportunities in terms of imported goods, where now it's a lot more costly to bring in, you know, that couch or the textiles, and they've started investing into new production lines to compete there. So, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. We've seen a lot of clients through the supply chain issues kind of find opportunities. I think also where we're finding hope is, you know, manufacturers are figuring out how to be more cost competitive. So there's been a lot of investment into kind of new production that is more efficient. But likewise, as well, the energy situation, while there is the energy availability issues and load shedding, we're seeing a much more competitive environment in terms of them investing into solar, putting in batteries, and really private generation for themselves. So we are seeing a lot of movement by top clients and good manufacturers that are reinvesting into the business and finding a way through all these supply shocks.
And that's encouraging. It really is. I mean, unfortunately, it adds cost and inflationary pressure to the process as well when you have to sort of double down on your infrastructure. But yes, absolutely. Making a plan is part of the South African DNA when it comes to doing business. Justin Schmidt is the head of manufacturing sector at Absa Retail and Business Bank. I also see today that Europe's biggest Russian gas buyers are trying to find alternative fuel suppliers and could burn more coal to cope with reduced gas flows from Russia. Now, those reduced gas flows as a result of sanctions that have been imposed on Russia by many, many countries around the world threaten to turn into an energy crisis for the Northern Hemisphere winter if they're not going to get their gas supplies refilled. Countries like Germany and Italy, Austria and the Netherlands have all said that their coal-fired plants could help to see the whole of the European continent through the crisis that has sent gas prices surging and, of course, has added to the challenge facing policymakers who are battling inflation. And for us, we need to get our coal to ports. We need to be able to get the coal. I know it's filthy. And I really don't support burning coal for a moment. But my goodness gracious me. Do you want Granny to die of cold in the Northern Hemisphere winter? Or do you want us to accelerate our efforts to decarbonize and to get things moving? And it's so interesting. It's so interesting, is it not, this idea that, you know, we have to go back to coal in order to plug the gap left by gas, which is supposed to be this great transition commodity to help decarbonize the planet. We need to decarbonize as fast as we can. But the reality is, with the sanctions on Russia because of the invasion of Ukraine, ultimately, it looks like Europe's going back to burning filthy old coal, at least for this winter anyway.
The Money Show.
Business books.
Helen. The reason I call her Helen is because she once introduced herself to me and said, you only remember anyone's name when they introduce themselves to you three times. And she introduced herself as Helen. And she's written a fabulous book on mindfulness, how to stay sane in an insane world. And Helen Nicholson is with us this evening. Helen is the author of the book. She is also the CEO of her own business, The Networking Company. It's a leadership development consultant. And seeing she's been doing it for a long time. We won't date each other on that particular front, Helen Nicholson. But it is mad. The world is completely and utterly nuts. Mindfulness isn't an awfully new concept, but you're reinvigorating it as a possible solution to the madness that surrounds us all the time. What's your thinking on mindfulness in our current context, Helen?
Thank you, Bruce. I think that mindfulness, I think what's happened is businesses have finally realized probably what Buddhist monks knew 2,000 years ago. And I think the neuroscience has become really compelling because now suddenly the science has come up or caught up with kind of ancient wisdom. And, you know, you can actually see MRI scans of how mindfulness practices actually manage to calm people's brains. And I think if there's anything we've learned over the last 3 years is that calming your brain will actually be a key future skill. So, you know, it has relevance now just from a personal resilience perspective, but I think it also has great relevance in business, because I think that when you're calm, when everyone else is losing their minds, you immediately are going to make better, more strategic decisions.
Talk to me about this concept of mindfulness. It's been around for a while, but I've kind of never really got to the bottom of what it entails and what it encapsulates. I don't think it's one thing. I think it's a multiplicity of things. Ultimately, it's about calming the hell down just allowing yourself some space to breathe.
I think it's, you know, there are many definitions. One of my favorite ones is when you bring your brain and your body into the same place at the same time. So in other words, it's focusing on doing one thing well. And I think a good example is if you garden, or if you do some kind of craft, or you're doing something with both hands, that immediately brings your attention, because then you're obviously not on your phone. And you find that, and human beings actually really like that. Our brains like doing one thing at a time. They don't like multitasking. Our brain is actually a single processing unit. It's not designed to be like your computer and have seven tabs opened at the same time, even though we think, and often, you know, women especially define themselves by their ability to multitask. And it turns out that no one can multitask. Our brain is happier and it does its best work when you just are doing, you know, you're single, you're unitasking.
And I couldn't agree with you more, because I'm incapable of doing more than one thing at once, and sometimes not even that. It's this very noisy world that we're in, and it's a cluttered world. And the more time that we're spending on digital devices, because they're easy, they're fun, they're interesting, they're interactive, the algorithms tell us what we want to what we want to read, and so they're very fulfilling. They're very fulfilling little friends to sit and talk to, but you know, they are also terribly distracting, and I worry not only for adults in this world of ours, but just as, you know, I look at the addictive nature of digital devices, because they are so affirming and engaging. And I just wonder where kids fit in all of this.
Yeah, I mean, one of the pieces of research that I actually quote in the book was, you know, that the rise of anxiety amongst young people completely tracks the rise of cell phone adoption. So there's no accidents around why our young people especially are feeling more anxiety, because the more addicted they are to their cell phones, the more their anxiety arises. But I think what's also interesting from an adult perspective is how, what was fundamental for me in the research for the book was how negative our brain actually is if you leave your brain to its natural devices. So in other words, if you don't actively train your brain to be more positive, it actually is, there are two things your brain is destined to do. It's one is to think and solve problems, and the other one is to scan for danger. So left to its own devices, your brain is not going to make you happy and it's not going to make you calm. And that's why you've actually got to take some active steps, whether it's mindfulness practices or practicing gratitude. You've got to actually step in and actually almost hack your brain to make it more positive. And I think that that's, you know, this big spiral of negativity we see in the world, and particularly in South Africa, that it's very easy to get caught up in that. And social media obviously plays a big role. And then I think when you've got the overlapping between negative social media plus your brain on its own going down its own kind of negative track, it becomes a very worrying kind of pattern. But it can be, you've actually got to interrupt it. And mindfulness is one of those pattern interrupters, which can actually make you think calmly. I mean, if I had a magic wand and could wave it over everyone listening right now, if you literally even practice this for 5 minutes a day, it makes you think better, it makes you calmer, it makes you happier. There are very few other things, probably other than exercise, that actually deliver such huge benefits. It's a habit to the power of 100. It's not just a habit, you know, standing on its own.
But you had your Arianna Huffington moment, didn't you? I mean, Arianna Huffington woke up in a pool of blood. You know, she just collapsed out of sheer exhaustion. And I'm not suggesting that you had the same sort of experience, but you certainly did have your own sort of realization that you couldn't continue at 400 kilometers an hour in the fast lane in a supercharged supercar all the time, that things had to change for you. And I think that's been, you've had your own awakening from that respect.
I mean, literally, I mean, and most people who have adopted some kind of mindfulness practice inevitably have some kind of health scare. You know, I think that's the only thing that actually kicks us into touch properly. So I burnt out quite spectacularly and nearly died on an Easter weekend in the Drakensberg a couple of years ago, where I'd had flu and, you know, I was self-medicating myself and I was impatient with my body as to why I wasn't getting better. And so I kind of put two antibiotics together and thought that I would, you know, doubly recover. And exactly, I thought so. And then, you know, clearly they contraindicated themselves and I ended up going into anaphylactic shock, which is not a, you know, in the middle of the Drakensberg, it's not really a great place to do that. So, you know, I was very lucky where they managed to race me off to Winterton and get lots of injections and stuff. But it was a wake up call because, you know, for my whole family to discover me kind of lying naked on the showered floor, kind of actually just finally surrendering and say, you know, I actually can't do this anymore. So, and I think that was my aha moment. And as I say, I think that, you know, I've had a friend recently that's been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And I think we're going to see a lot of that happening post-COVID, because effectively we've actually been through World War III and are still going through it. And, you know, people seem to think, and I think I've seen a lot of this happening in 2022, that, you know, this year is going to be better. And, you know, I think the economics are quite scary. You know, I was on a call with friends from London and New York yesterday, and they were saying that, you know, their electricity prices are doubling. I'm sitting in load shedding as we're busy talking to you right now. You know, the cost of living is going through the roof. We've got a war going on. So there's a lot of stuff. And I think that one of the things that mindfulness does for you is it makes you practice self-compassion better. So when you are kinder to yourself, then inevitably you become kinder to other people. And I definitely think kindness is going to be a currency both in business and our lives that we are going to be forced to practice a lot better.
I agree with you, but I also, there'll be lots of people listening to this saying, oh, come on, Helen, toughen up. Really? You know, it's a tough world. It's a cruel world. It's always tough and it's always cruel. Work is always hard. And only the paranoid survive, or some other quote that comes along the way. But I think we're becoming more aware of, you know, enough is enough, frankly. And you know, if you're working 7 days a week over an extended period of time, you are going to hit the wall, and it's going to be spectacular. And the time you lose in recovery, you're never going to be able to make up for again if you try to go back to your old habits.
Well, I think if you just use sleep as an example of that kind of old style way of working, where sleep deprivation is used as a badge of honor. And Jeff Bezos sleeps 8 hours every night, and he proudly proclaims that. And he says it's a key success factor in, you know, and he's obviously the richest man in the world. So I think he's got something going there. And, you know, I think that that whole boiler room, Wolf of Wall Street, you know, mentality around business specifically was that the person whose car was parked in the car parks for the longest was, you know, and that 7 days a week story. I think that we've gotten cleverer, hopefully, around our energy. And, you know, I went on a program in America a couple of years ago called The Corporate Athlete, which was all about sprinting and not being a marathon runner, around managing your energy. And I think that I personally have found that incredibly helpful. So to see every day as a sprint, and then you cross a finish line at a certain time, so you have that full stop at the end of your day, and then you recover properly and you sleep well at night, and then you're ready to rock and roll the next day. So I think that that marathon runner is an old style business paradigm. And I think, first of all, you'll have a team of burnt out people. And I think if there's anything we've learned recently is that you're going to need very smart, full of energy, fully engaged people in your team to be coping with all the stuff that we're all dealing with at the moment. So I think, and the second thing around that old style mentality of, you know, I'll sleep when I'm dead, et cetera, is the millennials and the Gen Zs, they don't believe that, and they won't stay with your company if that's your mentality.
And that is changing in a way that, you know, it started slowly, I think, 10 years ago, but mindfulness and people becoming more aware of, you know, life quality and all of that sort of stuff is a fundamental shift. And you do encourage people to sleep their way to the top, which is not something I'd ever thought I would see in any book anywhere. But you encourage it openly and with absolute clarity, Helen. You say, yes, sleep to the top, sleep your way to the top on a great mattress, Nochal.
Exactly. I always think if I didn't do my day job, I would be a mattress salesperson, because I always say to people, you know, when last did you invest in your sleep? You know, whether it's blackout curtains, it's buying a new mattress, you need a new mattress every 5 to 7 years. And, you know, getting the best quality linen, getting a blackout sleep mask, taking magnesium before you go to bed. These are all things we can do because we can hack our bodies to sleep better. And I mean, it's just become, I think, sleep deprivation is as big of an issue as climate change at the moment.
Yeah, but certainly if you're not getting a proper night's rest, and again, not everybody does need 8 hours. I mean, it's this sort of it's sort of touted as the ideal amount of sleep. I mean, whatever your body needs, your body needs. But this notion of you know, stress and distraction, and particularly late night doom scrolling, is the sort of stuff that drives people over the edge eventually.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I advocate is put your phone in the kitchen at night. So, you know, and buy an old style alarm clock, so that, because often people are using their phones as their alarm. And, you know, and then
who can sleep with that ticking? Who can sleep with that ticking noise? Jeez, like Helen. But
you need one of those silent old style digital ones.
Okay.
And gotcha. And then you are not tempted to do that doomsday scrolling, because that just wakes your brain up even more. So then it becomes, and I'm also the Epsom salts queen. I say to people, put a cup of Epsom salts in your bath before you go to bed, because then you get magnesium sulfate on the outside of your body. Take 2 slow release magnesium tablets. And what that does, it actually relaxes your body, especially if people are listening and they're waking up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Magnesium can be an absolute game changer instead of, you know, prescription meds.
I was about to go to prescription meds, but I'm glad you've not gone there. So late night cup of coffee, 2 magnesium tablets, and a little bit of internet before you go to bed. Boom. And then you'll be, passed out on the bathroom floor, no doubt, with blood coming out of your head, because it will drive you to the edge. Helen, thank you for the chat. I'm delighted that we've managed to catch up. You sent me your book absolutely ages ago, and we finally managed to connect. So I'm delighted about that. The author of Mindfulness, How to Stay Sane in an Insane World. It's fabulous. It is so easy to get your head around. It's filled with lovely quotes. And she even quotes Louis L'Amour. Remember? Oh, no, you wouldn't remember Louis L'Amour. Louis L'Amour, my brothers were fans of Louis L'Amour. Cowboy stories from the 1960s and 70s. Things littered my childhood. Never read one. But I've now read a quote from Louis L'Amour in Helen's book on mindfulness. And it is, so much of it is absolutely logical and common sense. But as my late great-grandfather, not my great-grandfather, but my grandfather who was great, once said, "There's nothing common about common sense, my boy." And so pick up the book, read it. You'll be very glad you did.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB, powering Africa's renewable energy transformation. The bravery to imagine. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
On to Other People's Money this evening. Kaiser Khanyaho is with us this evening. He is nowadays the spokesperson for the SIU, the Special Investigating Unit. He was long the head of communication for the SABC. He's been in his current job for 3 years. SABC, I think he got to his teens. And before that, he was at the Department of Justice. Has it been an entire career, Kaiser, in the public service? Good evening. There he is. I hear life. I hear life. I hear life. Kaiser, has your entire career been in the public service? Good evening.
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening to your listeners. Yes, my entire life has been in the public service. I was a teacher for some time. And then after that, I then went into communication. There were a few years in between where I went into private sector in the publishing industry, where we were publishing books. And then I went back into public service.
But you've had a long career in the public sector, which means that for the first time ever, we've got somebody on other people's money who's actually got a guaranteed pension because courtesy of the Public Investment Corporation, of course. And I'm assuming you're automatically enrolled into a government pension scheme, aren't you?
And at the moment, no.
Not?
Because I was on the SABC. I've just got back into it now, but I am sort of retired as I speak to you because I retired from the SABC.
Oh, okay. All right. Did you outlast Cloudy or did Cloudy outlast you? Who won that race?
He left before me. I left in November 2018 and he had left by that time.
It must have been wild. I mean, can you talk about it now, Kaiser, in terms of being the representative of an organization with a chief executive or with a chief operating officer who has gone completely off-piste, who is behaving in a way where there is absolutely no governance? I mean, it must have been insane.
I'm still thinking about writing a book. Wait for that moment.
Nobody will believe it.
Because I've got a lot of stories.
Nobody will believe it.
I've got a lot of stories to tell. I've been a spokesperson for almost 14 years, and I've gone through 10 boards and almost 10 or 11 CEOs.
Were you just holding on, hoping things would get better? I mean, lots of people get stuck in jobs that they, I mean, maybe you loved it. I don't know. Maybe you like the world of adrenaline. Did you just hope that one day it would get better and eventually you just had to go, you know what, I'm retiring. I'm out of here. It's a crazy place.
I was just doing my work. You must understand, as a communicator, you've got to do your work. It is not so much of your responsibility to be questioning decisions. You then need a lot of time to understand them and where they come from and communicate them. Therefore, for me, I was focusing on doing my job. I wasn't worried about who was in charge at that particular point. I will support you when you are in charge and we take it from there.
And your own personal integrity and your own sort of personal brand, if you like, because you've always been somebody who has been regarded as somebody with a strong level of personal integrity. Did you have to push back sometimes against some of those leaders, some of those boards to say, no, we're not going to tell it like that because of, I don't know, X, Y, and Z. It's against the law. It's not principled. It's not moral. I don't know where you would draw the line. But did you have to push back in that career against it, or do you just... You are the messenger, and off you go and deliver the message.
No, that's not what the communicator does. What people don't know, they only see you when you are out there speaking, but what they don't know is you sit in board meetings, you sit in exco meetings, and when decisions are made, you have got to give your advice in terms of communication. You are able to say, this cannot be this way, this cannot be that way. And that way, you are able to deal with those issues before they come to the public space. By the time they come to the public space, I've said whatever I wanted to say. I've disagreed with whatever certain things that they would have loved me to say. I would have done that by that time.
Have you ever said, no, I will not represent you in that fashion? Were you ever put under pressure and told, you need to lie for me, you need to tell this version of events, and gone, no, terribly sorry, but I can't do that for you?
Not necessarily in that way, but I've been able to say in a professional manner, this is not how it can be done, and these are the consequences. And in most of the instances, they had to understand, because I'm the one who has got to go out there. I've got to be convinced that whatever we're going to say is something that we need to say. But you need to understand also, as a communicator, it is your job to communicate the messages of the organization, whether you like them or you don't.
And that's always difficult, I suppose, and everybody has their tolerance levels for what they will and will not do. What drew you to the Special Investigating Unit? Because that's what a job that you've nearly been in for 3 years. You say you retired from the SABC. Clearly, you saw this as a second opportunity.
Yes, I retired from the SABC and I stayed home for a little while, just thinking and then looking forward at what I need to do. And then later on, the post became available and I was asked to apply, which I did. And then I got the job. And because at the time, I saw it as a challenge, because when I got appointed, the first thing that I said to me was, listen, you need, the SIU is doing so much work, but nobody knows what they are doing. It is the responsibility that we give to you. And I said, okay, challenge accepted. And I did that and I moved forward. And that's what I then was focused on doing. And I hope I've done a good job in it.
You haven't had a dull moment, have you? I mean, talk about landing in a job at precisely the right time. It is, I think, the professional communicator's dream job almost, because you start with a blank slate. You're doing a job of work which most sensible South Africans would support and would most certainly, I think, the biggest criticism would want faster action. But I think, you know, you're in a good space.
No, I'm definitely in a good space, because for me, it was a good challenge. And I've got a boss that really supports me a lot, Advocate Mutibi. He gave me a lot of support. He said to me, you'll get whatever you need. All that you need to do is put us out there. And I remember when I got the job, I think it was in October 2019. And they wanted me to start on the 1st of November. And I said to him, but can I, it's this long week, it's Christmas periods and whatever, people are relaxing, can I start in January? And then he said, no, I want you to start now. And I got appointed end of October and I started the 1st of November.
That's a very sharp turnaround. Now, you've got some young people in the background who maybe need a little request to say, could you tone it down just a little bit? I'm going to give you a moment to do precisely that.
Unfortunately, I'm at the hotel. Yeah, other people's children, and I'm in Burundi now, in Bujumbura.
You don't want to upset people in Burundi, but we do need to pause for a moment, Kaiser Ganyaho. Now we have context, we understand your current circumstances. But back with you in a moment where we get to talk about the nitty-gritty, about the money, about how somebody who's worked most of their career in the public sector thinks about money and how they prepare for a retirement at some point in the future and think about the future when it comes to money. The SIU spokesperson, Kaiser Ganyaho, ex-SABC, ex-Department of Justice, ex-publishing, ex-many things, but currently in Burundi talking to us.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB, powering Africa's renewable energy transformation. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
So Kaiser Ganyaho spent much of his career in the public service. I wonder, Kaiser Ganyaho, the SIU spokesperson on the line to us from Burundi, the noisy people in the background have no direct links to him. He is in a hotel, so don't shout at him. The thinking when it comes to the future, when it comes to money working in the public sector, how have you dealt with that? Have you been happy for the public sector to look after you in your old age, or have you embarked on your own thinking when it comes to money?
No, definitely I had to do both, because when I was in public service, I was on the pension fund of public service. And then when I left for the SABC, then obviously I had to move that to the SABC so that I'm able to then put it in the SABC pension fund, because it's different from what we have with government. And then that is what I retired from in 2018. And then I then had to start, when I started at the SIU, to start afresh and build from there while I'm on retirement on the other side.
And so have you sort of done private sector investing? Have you done your own unit trust investing? Have you got a private retirement annuity? How have you gone about it? Through purely through public investments, or have you gone private as well?
Yeah, there are some private transactions that I had to do. Staying in a household where you've got a brother who's the governor of the Reserve Bank,
you will not run away from such things. Yeah, and he's been our guest as well. I didn't realize you were brothers. That's very interesting. I mean, he's very pedantic. He's a bit of a pain in that respect, isn't he? Quite bossy.
Not definitely. He will, every time he sees you, he wants to check how far you with certain things. And you have got no way of saying no to that. Because he will show you. He will say, this is where things are going. And then you will clearly see that. And that's something that you cannot run away from in our position.
Oh, and you must be pretty proud of him. I mean, as governor of the Reserve Bank, he's in his second term as governor of the Reserve Bank, a former DG of National Treasury. He's an absolute bastion of moral rectitude as well. And I guess something of a role model to you as well.
No, definitely. I was telling him, I think, 2 weeks ago, I was saying to him, it doesn't come many times for anyone to have a relative who signs money. And he laughed at it, because he's the 10th governor of the Reserve Bank. How many people will live their lifetime and never have anybody they know who signed money?
No, exactly right. I mean, it must be exhausting, all of those banknotes. Now, are you allowed with a brother who is the governor of the Reserve Bank to have any bad money habits? I mean, do you spend money on expensive cars, expensive shoes, expensive hats? I don't know. Do you have any sort of naughty money habits that you wish you didn't have, but hey, they exist? Really clubby with shoes, for example. We caught her out on that one. What are your small Inyana skeletons?
I don't know whether I'm allowed to have that, not only because of having a brother like him, but also with the kind of work that you do. Because when you are in the spotlight, everybody wants to focus on you. Therefore, you try and limit everything. And the best luck for me is that I don't drink and I don't smoke. Therefore, I don't spend money on those things. I spend money on maybe going away with family and most of that. And I've got really, my household understands that for us, it is not about expensive cars and expensive things. It's about making sure that they've got a proper future. And my daughter just graduated early this month. And I'm saying, go on until you can, because money will be made available for you to have a good future.
And being in the public eye, particularly when you've got a role like yours, I mean, you can't have your reputation called into question ever. Even if you could afford a Breitling watch or a Louis Vuitton pair of shoes or whatever the case would be, you can't have people taking pictures of yourself with those accessories, simply because people will immediately go, oh, where did he get it from? And why is he wearing it? And why is he showing off his wealth? I mean, there's important signals that we all send all the time, don't we?
No, definitely. You can't do that, especially now when there's a you where most of the people that some of the people investigating are there because of exactly that. They got the money from government illegally, and they went and did a show off, bought cars and showed them on social media and all of that. I can't do that. For me, it's something that comes with the territory. But also, when I was growing up, my father is that kind of a person who was very clear from the word go to say, make sure that you look after the money. And when we got married, the first thing that he said to us is, make sure that you and your wife talk money together and plan together around the money issues. And he said to my sisters, listen here, prepare your life as if there won't be any man that will marry you. Be sustainable on your own, and the man that comes will just be a bonus.
And I mean, it's a deeply wise and empowering perspective to have, because so many people believe that they can be dependent and behave like dependents. And when things go wrong, because so often in relationships, people don't know where the money comes from and get caught short and are left in some cases destitute in many regards. And it's devastating, of course, as well. Those lessons that you got from your dad, have you passed those on with the same level of vigor Or do you leave that up to your brother to do, to be the grumpy uncle at Christmas time?
Not necessarily. I do that myself because I want them to understand the value of it. I want them to understand that one point in time I won't be available and they need to understand what to do going forward. And that for me is very important. And that is what give me sleepless nights when I see them, because we have raised them in a situation where we give them an allowance at the beginning of the month. You must then learn to live with that allowance for the whole month, like we do with our salaries.
Are you generous with that allowance, or is it enough to come get by, but not enough to get into trouble? Because I think that's an important
balancing act. No, definitely. We are not, I can say we are not generous because we've got many other things to do. But we make sure the idea behind it, little as it might be, is to say, this is what you get, and you've got to plan your life around it. Make sure you don't go over. Here and there, when they get over, and for a good reason, we can add here and there, but generally, they need to know that this is it. If you finish it in the first week, you are done for the remainder of the 3 weeks.
Fabulous. Kaiser Khanyaho, thank you so much. Spokesperson for the SIU. Other People's Money this evening, a little bit about the governor. We didn't get time to talk about Lerato, the niece, at the other radio station, but that's fine. Kaiser, thank you very much. On the line to us from Burundi this evening, talking about money and values and how you instill those values across generations.